All right, everyone, get ready for a deep dive. Today, we're going deep into the book of Daniel, specifically chapter 2.
Oh, yeah, chapter 2.
And right off the bat, there's something kind of unique about this section.
Yeah.
It's written in Aramaic.
Interesting.
Not Hebrew, which is pretty unusual for the Bible. So we're going to explore how the ancient Babylonian practices of dream interpretation are all mixed up in this biblical narrative.
Sounds fascinating.
You'll see how this mysterious dream totally throws a powerful king into a desperate search for answers.
A king having a dream.
And a captive named Daniel might just have the key to figuring it all out.
I'm intrigued. A blend of ancient Babylonian practices and the biblical narrative. Well, what makes this chapter so fascinating? It gives us this unique perspective, you know, a lens for viewing that clash between human ambition and divine power.
Okay, so picture this. We're in Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king, he's having this super vivid, disturbing dream, so much so that it wakes him up in a cold sweat.
Well,
but here's the thing. This isn't just any dream. For the Babylonians, dreams were a big deal.
Big deal how?
They didn't think dreams were just random thoughts floating around in your head. They believed they were messages from the gods. Especially for the king. So can you imagine the pressure Nebuchadnezzar must have felt to understand these divine messages?
Talk about high stakes. Dreams as messages from the gods. This really makes Nebuchadnezzar's desperation, like, way more relatable. They weren't just random, these dreams. They meant something. Especially for the king, right?
No kidding. So he calls in his top advisors. We're talking magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, like the A-team of the mystical world.
Wow.
But there's a catch. He demands they tell him not only what the dream means, but what he actually dreamed.
Whoa, hold on. He wanted them to tell him his dream.
Exactly. Put yourself in their shoes. Can you imagine?
Not a chance. That's intense. I mean, he's not just asking for advice. He's testing their power, their loyalty. He's got to be completely sure he can trust whatever interpretation they come up with.
Right. I wouldn't want to be on their team right then. And, well, as you can probably guess, none of the king's advisors can do it.
Of course not. Who can remember a dream on demand like that, let alone someone else's dream?
It's impossible. Their failure, it really shows the limitations of human wisdom, even for the most skilled experts in the Babylonian court.
So true. This episode, it really highlights that clash, you know, between human pride and divine knowledge. Like, the Babylonians, they had this super intricate system for dream interpretation, but it was still based on, you know, what they observed and figured out themselves. They were meticulous about collecting signs and interpreting them.
Signs? What kind of signs?
Everything. Dreams, animal entrails, what was happening in the stars.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure trying to read all those signs.
It really is.
It's so different from the Hebrew belief, right?
Different how?
Well, the Hebrews believed in one God who communicates directly. But I can understand that desperation to understand the dream. Like, if you believed the gods were sending you messages in your sleep, wouldn't you be scrambling for answers too?
Oh, absolutely. Imagine the stakes. I mean, these interpretations could influence entire kingdoms, could sway political decisions, even determine, like, the outcome of wars.
So what exactly was this dream that had Nebuchadnezzar so freaked out? Picture this. He sees this giant statue.
A statue?
It's made of all these different metals. And each metal, it represents a different kingdom that's going to rise and fall. Now, the idea of successive kingdoms, that's not so strange.
Oh.
But there's a twist. Out of nowhere, this mysterious stone appears. It smashes the statue to smithereens, and then it grows into a mountain that covers the whole earth.
Whoa, what a dream. And the symbolism here, it's crucial. Those different metals, you know, gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay, they represent a decline in power and stability. But that stone represents God's eternal kingdom, the one that will ultimately overcome, like, every earthly power.
So that's where Daniel, our hero, steps onto the scene. He's a Jewish captive, but he's known for his wisdom and his unwavering faith in God. And unlike those bewildered Babylonian wise men, Daniel, he's got a direct line to the source of all knowledge.
Yeah, Daniel's different. It's not about his own intelligence or any training he got in Babylonian methods. He makes it very clear that it's his God who reveals mysteries. It's a big statement about divine power, how it trumps human understanding.
What an entrance. Daniel, he just comes right out and reveals both the dream and the interpretation.
Bold move.
He makes it super clear that this knowledge, it's a gift from God, not some human trick. Then he walks everyone through each part of the statue, explaining what it all represents.
So what would he say?
Well, he starts with the head of gold. That's Nebuchadnezzar himself. Then there are three more kingdoms, each one weaker than the last.
Each weaker than the last. Hmm. And what about the fourth kingdom, the one made of iron and clay? That's got to be interesting, right? I bet scholars are still debating exactly what it stands for.
Wait, are you saying there's more than one way to look at this prophecy?
Of course. There are two main interpretations, actually. The Roman view and the Greek view.
Oh, wow. Two different views.
Yeah, the Roman view is the more traditional one. It identifies that fourth kingdom as the Roman Empire, you know, vast power, but then eventual decline, that whole thing. And interestingly, this view often links those iron and clay feet of the statue to the idea that the Roman Empire might actually revive or, you know, continue in some form. It even ties into prophecies about the end times.
So this interpretation has kind of a theological angle to it?
You could say that, yeah. It aligns with a certain way of understanding biblical prophecy. It emphasizes this idea that empires, they have a kind of continuity, and that God's kingdom, it will ultimately triumph over all of them, over all earthly powers.
Okay, I see. What about the Greek view? How's that different?
Well, the Greek view, it's often favored by scholars who approach the text from more of a historical perspective. They see that fourth kingdom as Alexander the Great's empire. So the iron, that represents Alexander's military strength. But the clay, that symbolizes the internal conflicts and instability that ripped his empire apart after he died.
So this interpretation is more grounded in what actually happened historically?
Exactly. This interpretation, it sees the statue as representing a very specific lineup of empires, ones that Daniel and his audience would have known very well.
Which empires?
Babylon, Media, Persia, and then Greece. It fits really nicely within the historical context of the book, offering a reading of the prophecy that's more grounded in a specific timeline.
Okay, two different ways to look at the prophecy. Fascinating.
Each with its own strengths and weaknesses.
But before we get too lost in the debate about those kingdoms, let's go back to that dramatic moment with the stone smashing the statue. It's got to be a pretty clear symbol of God's kingdom, right?
Oh, absolutely. It represents like that unstoppable force, you know, of divine power, the one that will crush all earthly kingdoms and establish like an eternal reign of justice and peace.
That's a powerful image. It really contrasts with how fragile all those kingdoms represented by the statue are. So how does Nebuchadnezzar react to all this? I mean, here he is being told that his kingdom, along with all the others, is going to crumble. Is he furious?
Nope. Actually, he's impressed. Maybe even a little awed. He acknowledges that Daniel's God is superior to his own gods.
Wait, really? That doesn't seem like something a powerful king would typically do, admitting to a captive that their god is stronger.
I know, right?
It's interesting. What do you think was going through his head at that moment?
Well, you know, if we think about the big picture, I think it reveals something really important about this chapter, the tension between human pride and divine sovereignty. Nebuchadnezzar, for all his power and ambition, he's still ultimately accountable to a higher authority.
It's definitely a humbling reminder for all of us. No matter how powerful someone seems, they're not above divine power. This episode, it really drives home the limits of human wisdom compared to divine revelation, wouldn't you say?
Precisely. Through his interpretation, Daniel shows that true knowledge and power come from God, not from being clever or having political power. It's a message that speaks across time and cultures.
And it definitely resonates with us today, but we've been so focused on Nebuchadnezzar. What about Daniel? What happens to him after he drops this mind-blowing prophecy?
Well, here's where things get interesting. Instead of being punished, you know, for basically defying the king, Daniel gets showered with honors and rewards. Nebuchadnezzar promotes him to a position of high authority, making him ruler over the entire province of Babylon.
Wow. From captive to governor because of one dream interpretation. Talk about a career change.
It really shows how much his faith and wisdom impacted the king.
Yeah.
But what's even more remarkable is what Daniel does with this newfound power.
Okay, now I'm really curious. What does he do?
Instead of using his position for personal gain or, you know, enjoying all the perks of power, Daniel uses his influence to help his friends.
His friends?
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He asks Nebuchadnezzar to appoint them to positions of authority within the province. Basically, he's ensuring their safety and well-being.
That's incredible. He could have easily just focused on himself, but he chooses to lift up his friends and use his influence for good. It really makes you think, what would we do in a situation like that?
It really does. His actions show real integrity, you know, and loyalty. It's such a powerful example of servant leadership.
Yeah.
It reinforces the idea that true power isn't about grabbing wealth or status. It's about using your influence to help others.
This deep dive is full of surprises. This story, it's so much more than figuring out a dream. It's about the choices we make when we're given power, the importance of sticking to our values, and the strength of faith, even when things are rough. It makes you think about the stones in your own life, the things that challenge you to grow and become a better person.
I love that the stones in our own lives, it really makes you think. The book of Daniel has resonated with people for centuries because it speaks to these core human experiences and challenges. And you know what's really interesting? The way this chapter hints at themes that we'll see play out in later chapters of Daniel.
Oh, a glimpse into the future. Tell me more.
Well, we've seen how Daniel, even as a young captive, shows such incredible wisdom and courage. He stands up for what he believes in, even when a powerful king threatens him. This sets the stage for his future run-ins with other rulers and more challenges where his faith and integrity will be put to the test.
So we can look forward to more dramatic showdowns, divine interventions, and maybe even a few more plot twists.
You can definitely count on it. The Book of Daniel is a masterclass in storytelling, weaving together historical drama, prophetic visions, and profound theological insights. Just when you think you've got it figured out, it throws you a curveball. It challenges you to think deeper, to question your assumptions, and to consider what it all means for your own life.
I'm ready for the ride. But before we race ahead to the rest of Daniel's adventures, let's take a moment to reflect on what we've learned so far from this chapter. What are some key takeaways you think our listeners should hold on to?
Key takeaways. Well, one of the most striking things about this chapter is how much it emphasizes God's sovereignty. Even in the heart of this mighty empire, with its intricate systems of divination and human wisdom, it's ultimately God who holds the key to the future.
It's a powerful reminder that there's something at work in the world that's beyond our understanding and control, something that ultimately shapes the course of history. And if you're ever feeling overwhelmed by all the chaos and uncertainty in the world, it's good to remember that.
Exactly. And this force, as we see through Daniel, isn't distant or uncaring. It's actively involved in people's lives, even those who seem powerless, like captives in a foreign land.
And this divine power is accessible through faith and prayer. We see how Daniel's unwavering trust in his God allows him to face challenges, interpret mysteries, and even influence the king's decisions. It's an encouraging message for anyone who's facing uncertainty or feels powerless in their own life.
Absolutely. This chapter encourages us to look beyond our immediate circumstances, you know, to see the bigger picture, to trust in a power greater than ourselves, and seek guidance from a source that goes beyond human wisdom.
That message really hits home, especially in our world today. I mean, we're bombarded with information and so many different perspectives. It's easy to feel overwhelmed by it all.
Oh, I know. It can be tempting to just rely on what we think we know or get caught up in the latest trends and ideologies. But this chapter, it reminds us that there's a deeper source of truth, a wisdom that goes beyond what we can figure out on our own.
And that wisdom is available to anyone who seeks it, no matter who they are or where they come from. Just like Daniel, we can tap into this divine knowledge through prayer, studying, and being open to guidance.
And just as Daniel used his newfound influence to help others, we're called to use our knowledge, our talents, and our resources to make a positive difference in the world.
So it's not just about figuring out ancient dreams or understanding historical prophecies. It's about applying those timeless principles of faith, integrity, and service to our own lives, our own time. It's about recognizing that we're all part of a larger story, a story that's ultimately guided by a divine hand.
Beautiful put. But the story doesn't end there. Remember, this is just the beginning of Daniel's journey. There are more challenges waiting for him, more prophecies to uncover, and more opportunities for him to demonstrate the power of his faith.
I can't wait to see what happens next. But before we jump into the next chapter, let's zoom in on one of the most debated aspects of this dream.
Okay, which part?
The identities of those mysterious kingdoms represented by the statue. It's a question that's fascinated scholars for centuries, and there's no easy answer. As we mentioned earlier, there are two main schools of thought, the Roman view and the Greek view. What are your thoughts on these differing interpretations?
Well, both interpretations have their own strengths and weaknesses. It's important to remember that these are different perspectives on the same prophecy. The Roman view, which is the more traditional one, sees the fourth kingdom as the Roman Empire. You know, vast power, but eventual decline, that whole deal. Interestingly, this view often links those iron and clay feet of the statue to the idea that the Roman Empire might revive or continue in some form, tying into prophecies about the end times.
So this interpretation is looking ahead, connecting the dream to a much broader timeline.
You could say that, yeah. It aligns with a particular way of understanding biblical prophecy, emphasizing the continuity of empires and the eventual triumph of God's kingdom over earthly powers. The Roman view is very popular among those who see a strong connection between events in the book of Daniel and the end times, as described in other parts of the Bible.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the Greek view? How does that differ?
Well, the Greek view is often favored by scholars who approach the text from a more historical perspective. They see that fourth kingdom as the empire of Alexander the Great. The iron represents Alexander's military strength, while the clay symbolizes the internal divisions and instability that led to the fragmentation of his empire after he died.
So this one focuses more on the historical context surrounding the Book of Daniel.
Exactly. This interpretation sees the statue as representing a specific sequence of empires that were well known to Daniel and his audience: Babylon, Media, Persia, and then Greece. It offers a more chronologically grounded reading of the prophecy, fitting nicely within the historical context of the book. It suggests that the dream was a message about events closer to Daniel's own time, rather than a prediction of things to come much later.
So we've got two very different ways of looking at the same prophecy, each with its own strengths and weaknesses.
And that's just the beginning. We'll dive deeper into these different perspectives after a quick break.
Stay tuned.
Welcome back. You know, before we move on, I think we should maybe circle back to Nebuchadnezzar's reaction to Daniel's prophecy.
Yeah. What about it?
It might seem kind of strange that he wasn't more upset, you know, about his kingdom eventually being replaced. I mean, remember, he saw himself as the head of gold.
That's true. He'd be long gone by the time those other kingdoms came along. Maybe it wasn't such bad news for him personally, you know. But it does raise an interesting question.
Yeah, what's that?
Was Nebuchadnezzar actually converting to Daniel's God when he acknowledged him? Or was it something else?
That's a great question, and it's one that scholars have been going back and forth on for ages. While he does call Daniel's God the God of gods and the Lord of kings, we got to remember that Babylonian religion wasn't about just one god.
Right, they had a whole pantheon of gods.
Exactly. So was Nebuchadnezzar simply adding another powerful deity to his collection?
It's possible, right.
Definitely a possibility. He might have seen Daniel's God as like a particularly strong deity, someone deserving of respect, and maybe even a little, you know, appeasement. Remember, he immediately orders offerings and incense to be presented to Daniel.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It's almost like he's trying to, like, get on this new God's good side, just in case.
It really is.
It's a fascinating glimpse into how a powerful ruler might deal with, like, a belief system that challenges everything they thought they knew.
Absolutely. It highlights how complex religious belief and political power were back then, you know, in the ancient world. I think Nebuchadnezzar's response, rather than being this clear-cut conversion, was more like a practical acknowledgement of a higher power. He might not have totally abandoned all his other gods, but he recognized the power of Daniel's God.
Yeah. Even that is a pretty big shift for someone who started out so, like, arrogant and obsessed with control. It really says a lot about how powerful Daniel's faith was and how undeniable the evidence of, you know, divine intervention seemed to be. What stands out to you about this whole interaction between Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel?
You know, I think it really underscores that encountering the divine can shake even the most deeply held beliefs. It can force someone to reevaluate their entire worldview, even for someone like Nebuchadnezzar, you know, a powerful king.
Yeah. It's almost like he had to confront something bigger than himself.
Exactly.
So maybe Nebuchadnezzar didn't become a devout follower of Daniel's God, but he definitely learned something about humility and the limits of human power. But we've spent a lot of time on Nebuchadnezzar. What about Daniel? What happens to him after he delivers this incredible prophecy?
This is where things get really interesting. Instead of facing punishment, you know, for defying the king, Daniel is showered with honors and rewards. Nebuchadnezzar promotes him to a super high position, actually, making him the ruler over the entire province of Babylon.
No way. Seriously. Mm-hmm. He goes from captive to governor just by interpreting a dream. That's one heck of a promotion.
It really is. It's a testament to the power of his faith, you know, and the wisdom he showed. But what's even more remarkable is what Daniel chooses to do with this newfound power and influence.
Okay, now you've really got me curious. Tell me more.
So instead of going after personal gain or, you know, enjoying all the perks that came with his position, Daniel uses his influence to help his friends.
His friends?
Yeah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He asks Nebuchadnezzar to appoint them to positions of authority within the province. He's basically ensuring their safety and well-being.
That's incredible. He could have easily used his new position for his own benefit, but instead he chooses to lift up his friends. You know, he uses his influence for good. It makes you wonder, like, what would we do in that kind of situation?
It's a good question to ask ourselves, isn't it? Daniel's actions really show true integrity and loyalty.
For sure.
It's such a powerful example of what servant leadership really looks like. It reinforces that idea that, you know, true power is about using your influence to help others, not about building yourself up or gaining status.
I love that. This deep dive has been full of surprises. I'm realizing this story is so much more than just figuring out a dream. It's about the choices we make when we're faced with power, the importance of staying true to what we believe in, and the strength of faith, even when things are tough. Makes you think about the stones in your own life, you know, the things that challenge you to grow, to become a better person.
I love that the stones in our own lives, it really makes you think. And you know, the Book of Daniel has resonated with people for centuries because it speaks to those universal human experiences, those challenges we all face. And here's something interesting to consider. The way this chapter kind of foreshadows themes that'll play out in later chapters of Daniel.
Ooh, a sneak peek into the future. I'm all ears.
So we see how Daniel, even as a young captive, shows remarkable wisdom and courage. He stands up for what he believes in, even when a powerful king threatens him. This sets the stage for his future encounters with other rulers, for more challenges where his faith and integrity will be tested even more.
So we can look forward to more dramatic showdowns, divine interventions, and maybe even a few more plot twists.
Oh, you can definitely count on it. The Book of Daniel is a masterclass in storytelling, you know, blending historical drama, prophetic visions, and profound theological insights. Just when you think you've got it figured out, it throws a curveball at you. It challenges you to think deeper, to question your assumptions, and to think about what it all means for your own life.
I'm ready for the ride, but before we jump ahead to the rest of Daniel's adventures, let's pause and reflect on what we've learned from this chapter. What are some key takeaways you think our listeners should hold on to?
Key takeaways, Well, one of the most striking things about this chapter is its emphasis on God's sovereignty. Even in the middle of this mighty empire, with all its systems of divination and human wisdom, it's ultimately God who holds the key to the future.
Right. It's this powerful reminder that there's something bigger at work in the world, something beyond our understanding and control that ultimately shapes the course of history. And, you know, if you're ever feeling overwhelmed by all the chaos and uncertainty in the world, it's good to remember that.
I agree. And this force, this power we see through Daniel, it isn't distant or uncaring. It's actively involved in people's lives, even those who seem powerless, like captives in a foreign land.
And we see that this divine power, it's accessible through faith and prayer. We see how Daniel's unwavering trust in his God enables him to face these challenges, you know, interpret mysteries, and even influence the king's decisions. It's a really encouraging message for anyone who's facing uncertainty or feels powerless in their own life.
Absolutely. This chapter encourages us to look beyond our immediate circumstances, to see the bigger picture, to trust in a power greater than ourselves, and to seek guidance from a source that goes beyond human wisdom.
That message really resonates, especially in today's world. We're bombarded with information and so many different perspectives. It's easy to get lost in it all.
Oh, I know. It can be tempting to just rely on what we think we know or get swept up in the latest trends and ideologies. But this chapter, it reminds us that there's a deeper source of truth, a wisdom that goes beyond what we can figure out on our own.
Yeah, and that wisdom is available to anyone who seeks it, right? It doesn't matter who they are or where they come from. Just like Daniel, we can tap into this divine knowledge through prayer, through studying, and by being open to guidance.
Right, and just as Daniel used his newfound influence to help others, we're called to use our knowledge, talents, and resources to make a positive difference in the world.
So it's not just about figuring out ancient dreams or understanding historical prophecies. It's about applying those timeless principles, you know, faith, integrity, service, to our own lives, to our own time. It's about recognizing that we're all part of something so much bigger than ourselves, a story that's ultimately guided by a divine hand.
Beautifully put. But the story doesn't end there. Remember, this is just the beginning of Daniel's journey. There are more challenges ahead, more prophecies to be revealed, more opportunities for him to demonstrate the power of his faith.
I can't wait to see what happens next. But before we jump into the next chapter, let's dive into one of the most debated aspects of this dream, the identity of those mysterious kingdoms, the ones represented by the statue.
You mean like ready to unpack this puzzle?
Exactly, ready to unpack it. As we mentioned earlier, there are two main schools of thought, the Roman view and the Greek view. What are your thoughts on these different interpretations?
Well, both interpretations have their own strengths and weaknesses, right? And it's really important to understand that these are just different perspectives on the same prophecy. The Roman view, which is the more traditional interpretation, sees the fourth kingdom as the Roman Empire. You know, vast power, but eventual decline, that whole thing. And interestingly, this view often connects those iron and clay feet of the statue to the idea that the Roman Empire might actually revive or continue in some form, tying into prophecies about the end times.
So this interpretation is looking ahead, connecting the dream to a much broader timeline.
Yeah, you could say that. It aligns with a particular way of understanding biblical prophecy. It emphasizes the continuity of empires and the eventual triumph of God's kingdom over earthly powers. This Roman view is very popular among those who see a strong connection between events in the Book of Daniel and the end times, as described in other parts of the Bible.
Okay, that makes sense. So what about the Greek view? How does that one differ?
The Greek view is often favored by scholars who approach the text from, you know, a more historical perspective. They see the Fourth Kingdom as Alexander the Great's empire. The iron represents his military strength, while the clay, it symbolizes all the internal conflicts, you know, the instability that led to the empire fragmenting after Alexander died.
So this interpretation focuses more on the historical context surrounding the Book of Daniel.
Exactly. This interpretation sees the statue as representing a specific sequence of empires that would have been well known to Daniel and his audience.
Which empires?
We're talking Babylon, Media, Persia, and then Greece. This view, it fits nicely within the historical context of the book. It offers a reading of the prophecy that's more grounded in a specific timeline. It suggests that this dream was a message about events that were closer to Daniel's own time rather than a prediction of things to come much later.
So two very different ways of looking at the same prophecy. Makes you wonder which one is right.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And, you know, there's no easy answer. Both the Roman and Greek interpretations, they've got their own strengths and weaknesses. And the debate's still going strong today. But, you know, I think what's more important than trying to pick a winner is understanding why these different interpretations exist and what they can tell us about how people have understood this prophecy over time throughout history.
That's a great point. It's not about being right or wrong. It's about appreciating that this ancient text is complex, that there are multiple valid ways to interpret it. It encourages us to think for ourselves and to really engage with the material on a deeper level.
Exactly. The beauty of a text like Daniel is that it invites multiple interpretations, and that sparks conversations, encourages deeper engagement with the ideas. And you know what? There's another layer to this debate that we haven't even touched on yet.
Oh, wow. Another layer. I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
Well, some scholars argue that the identity of these specific kingdoms, it might not even be the main point of the prophecy at all. They suggest that the real focus is on this broader idea, God's sovereignty over human history.
So maybe it's less about, you know, pinpointing specific empires and more about those bigger themes, those ideas of divine power versus human ambition.
Exactly. Think about it. That statue, no matter which empires it represents, ultimately symbolizes the fragility of all earthly powers and how temporary they are. The stone, on the other hand, represents the eternal nature of God's kingdom, which will outlast all human kingdoms. It's a message that speaks to anyone who's ever felt overwhelmed by the chaos and uncertainty in the world.
Yeah, it makes you pause and think about what really matters in the grand scheme of things. I think a lot of people listening can relate to that feeling. Wanting something solid, something enduring, in a world that can feel so chaotic, so unpredictable.
I agree. And it's a message that encourages us to shift our perspective, to look beyond the immediate struggles and recognize that there are bigger forces at work. Even when things seem so challenging, we're reminded that there's a higher power guiding history towards a greater purpose. It's a really powerful message of hope, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. It's a message that's just as relevant for us today as it was for Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. So while the debate about those specific kingdoms continues, the core message of this prophecy remains clear. God is in control and his kingdom will ultimately prevail. It's a pretty reassuring thought.
For sure. And it's a message that's just as relevant today as it was back then for Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. It reminds us that there's more to life than the ups and downs of empires and kingdoms. There's a bigger story unfolding and we all have a role to play in it.
I love that. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Daniel chapter 2, I'm left with this sense of awe at like the vastness of history and the enduring power of faith. It's a reminder that we're all part of something much bigger than ourselves, part of a story that's being guided by a divine hand.
That's beautifully said. And remember, it's a story that's still being written. The choices we make, the actions we take, they all shape how that story unfolds.
Right. So let's all try to be wise interpreters of our own time, right? Let's seek truth. Let's pursue justice. And let's live in a way that reflects those enduring values of Daniel's incredible faith.
That's a great way to put it.
And on that note, we'll leave you with one final thought to ponder. We've seen how, in ancient times, people saw dreams as messages from God. But how do we interpret those significant events in our own lives today? What signs are we missing? And how can we discern what's true from all the noise, all the information overload in our world? Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep. Okay, so let's break down these different interpretations of that fourth kingdom, starting with the Roman view. What are the key arguments there?
Well, the Roman view is the, I guess you could say, more traditional one, seeing the Fourth Kingdom as representing the Roman Empire. Makes sense, right? The Romans, they had vast power, but ultimately their empire declined. The interesting thing about this interpretation is that it often links those iron and clay feet to the idea that the Roman Empire might actually be revived or continue in some form. Some people tie this back to prophecies about the end times, you know?
So this view connects Nebuchadnezzar's dream to a much broader timeline, even stretching into the future.
Yeah, that's a key part of it. It aligns with a certain way of understanding biblical prophecy, emphasizing the continuity of empires throughout history and how God's kingdom will ultimately triumph over all of them, over all earthly powers. This interpretation is popular among those who see a connection between events in the book of Daniel and the end times, as described in other parts of the Bible.
Okay, so that's one perspective. Now, what about the Greek view? How does that one differ?
Well, the Greek view tends to be favored by scholars who approach the text from a more, you know, historical perspective. They see the Fourth Kingdom as the empire of Alexander the Great. The iron would represent Alexander's military might, while the clay symbolizes those internal conflicts and the instability that ultimately led to his empire breaking apart after his death.
So this interpretation focuses more on the historical context surrounding the book of Daniel rather than making predictions about the future.
Exactly. This interpretation sees the statue as representing a specific sequence of empires that Daniel and his audience would have known well. We're talking Babylon, Media, Persia, and then Greece. It offers a reading of the prophecy that's grounded in a specific timeline and fits well within the historical context. It suggests that the dream was primarily about events closer to Daniel's own time, rather than a prediction of things to come much later.
So we have two very different ways of looking at the same prophecy. It makes you wonder, is one of these interpretations considered the right one?
Well, that's the question that keeps scholars debating, isn't it? There's no single definitive answer that everyone agrees on. Both the Roman and Greek interpretations have their own strengths and weaknesses, and it's a debate that's likely to continue. But I think what's more important than trying to pick a winner is understanding why these different interpretations exist and what they can tell us about how people have understood this prophecy throughout history.
I like that approach. It's not about being right or wrong, but appreciating that this ancient text is complex and that there could be multiple valid ways to interpret it. It encourages us to think for ourselves and to really engage with the material.
Exactly. The beauty of a text like Daniel is that it invites multiple interpretations and that sparks conversations, encourages deeper engagement with the ideas. You know what? There's another layer to this debate that we haven't even touched on.
Oh, wow. Another layer. Tell me more.
That scholars believe that the specific identities of these kingdoms might not even be the main point of the prophecy at all. They suggest that the real focus should be on the broader idea of God's sovereignty over human history.
So maybe it's not so much about, you know, pinpointing exactly which empires are represented by the statue, but more about these bigger themes like divine power versus human ambition.
Exactly. The statue, no matter which empires it stands for, ultimately symbolizes how fragile and temporary all those earthly powers are. The stone, on the other hand, represents the eternal nature of God's kingdom, the one that will eventually outlast all human kingdoms. It's a message that speaks to anyone who's ever felt overwhelmed by the chaos and uncertainty in the world.
Yeah. It makes you pause and think about what really matters in the grand scheme of things. And I think a lot of our listeners can relate to that feeling of wanting something solid, something enduring, in a world that can feel so chaotic, so unpredictable at times.
It's a message that encourages us to shift our perspective, to look beyond those immediate struggles and recognize that there are larger forces at work. Even when things seem incredibly challenging, we're reminded that there's a higher power, one that's guiding history toward a greater purpose, a powerful message of hope.
It really is a message that's just as relevant for us today as it was for Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar back then. So while the debate about those specific kingdoms continues, the core message of the prophecy is clear. God is in control, and his kingdom will ultimately prevail. It's a pretty reassuring thought in a world that can often feel so uncertain.
Absolutely, and it's a message that's just as relevant for us today as it was for Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar all those years ago. It reminds us that there's more to life than just the rise and fall of empires and kingdoms. There's a bigger story unfolding, and each of us has a role to play in it.
That's a great way to put it. As we wrap up this deep dive into Daniel chapter 2, what stands out to me is that sense of awe at the vastness of history. The enduring power of faith. It's a reminder that we're all part of something much bigger than ourselves, a story that's ultimately guided by a divine hand.
Beautifully said. And remember, that story, it's still being written. The choices we make, the actions we take, they all contribute to how that story unfolds. We should all strive to be, you know, wise interpreters of our own time. Seek truth, pursue justice. and live in a way that reflects those values, those enduring values of Daniel's incredible faith.
That's a perfect note to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Book of Daniel. We'll be back soon with more fascinating explorations of ancient wisdom and its relevance for today's world. Until then, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.